Our first speaker, Stephen D. from Kentfield, California.
Hey, everybody. I'm Steve, alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
And I'm still hungover from last night's meeting. That thing was unbelievable. When I walked in and they were thumping the music and the DJ was rocking, and I don't think I've ever experienced anything like that. And we had gone, a friend of mine who's here, we had gone to the International Convention in Toronto, and that was the closest I felt to getting high in sobriety as 100,000 alcoholics. Last night was one of those experiences just where it was just electric. And I'm really grateful to be sober. I was just thinking this morning, today is my anniversary almost 30 years ago. I had left a party on Fire Island in New York, and I got in the car, and I was out of my mind, blind, drunk, and I remember waking up a few times going off the freeway, and I kept catching myself as I was going off the freeway, and I kept driving. Next thing I knew, I felt a thump, and I looked up, and I couldn't see over the hood of my car, and I had fallen asleep. My foot went down on the accelerator. I went through a utility pole, a number of trees, stopped the car, didn't have a seatbelt on, nothing happened. I grabbed a bag of dope under the seat, threw it over the fence because I saw the cops in the rearview mirror. And, I mean, essentially, that should have been the end of me. I mean, I hit a pole going 90 miles per hour, and, nothing happened to me. But I got arrested, spent the night in jail, and I didn't get sober after that. But, I was just thinking today, that was Labor Day almost 30 years ago, and I'm coming up on 24 years sober. And I'll tell you, it's been a wild ride for me. I just there's no way. Almost 24 years ago, I was a bartender at Club Med, and I got 12-stepped. And there's no way. When I got here, I was $30,000 in debt. I was making $20 a month, and I just wanted somebody to take me home with them from Club Med and give me a life. And there's no way you could fast forward from there to now. I mean, never in my wildest dreams could I have imagined that my life could have turned out so good. And all I did is I went to AA, I got 12-stepped at this Club Med, and I did what I was told, and I stayed willing for 24 years, and my life is beyond my wildest dreams. And it's almost in spite of me, I've had a sponsor, I have home group, I go to meetings, I average 3 meetings a week. I sponsor guys, I work the steps I use in my life. Everything I've learned here the first week at that Club Med, if I just carried that forward to today, that's all that matters. I mean, that's the beauty of this program for me, is that it's very simple. And, I grew up in New York in an alcoholic household, and I had a father that was an alcoholic that would turn into the Incredible Hulk when he drank. He'd get violent, and you didn't know what was going to happen. And, so fear was the big word, man. That should have been written on our living room wall, because you just didn't know what was going to happen once he started drinking. And, alcoholic family, alcoholism all over my family on both sides. And that was the norm. And my grandfather was like an Irish, like an alcoholic Archie Bunker. Picture Archie Bunker, he's a drunk. And so these are my role models. And, I just remember growing up, I just wanted to be anywhere but there. And I would escape through playing basketball. I'd just leave and go play basketball at the park for hours. And I just remember, lying from the start. I just felt less than, I just, no matter what I did, it never made me feel okay. And, I don't know whether I was born that way or what, but once I started drinking, alcohol was the solution. I mean, when I didn't have a sober breath from 17 to 27, I ended up going to college. I got a full scholarship to play basketball. And what happened to me is that was my license, A, to get out of that insane asylum I was in, but B, I just got wasted 24/7 for the next 4 years. So I didn't have an expense to worry about. and I could just party. And what happened with me is that, you know, I mean, they say fun with problems, just problems. From the start, when I would drink, I just didn't know what was going to happen. I would end up doing things and being in places that never in a million years would have done otherwise. And, you know, even my closest friends would say, Steve's a great guy, but when he drinks, you don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, just a lot of fights. You know, I had that, like, egomaniac with low self-esteem. You know, I mean, to the outside world, it was always important what everybody thought of me, but inside I just had, you know, I just felt like a fraud. And I would just lie. I was a pathological liar. And I remember by the end, you know, I mean, it got to the point where, I mean, I remember snorting coke during the coach's pregame talk. I would drink sometimes before games. And I lived to get loaded. And, you know, by my last year, the guy said, you know, he called me and he said, you're a pathological liar. And, you know, I want you to, you know, quit, give up your scholarship. And he was right, you know. And to this day, I'm still looking for that guy. He's gone MIA. And, you know, I owe him an amends for sure. And, you know, what ended up happening is, you know, I got out of there and the life, you know, I figured out early, I like to go to nightclubs, and I figured out early the way for me to do it was to just work at clubs, because then I'd get paid to be there. And so I'd work at these clubs, and I remember, you know, I would go through periods where I'd say, okay, it's the vodka. So I remember, just let me drink beer. Then I remember I would line up white wine spritzers on the wall. I'd have 20 of them lined up. You know, I never had a social drink in my life. You know, I drank to check out. And, you know, I just never felt comfortable in my own skin. And as soon as I drank, it was like almost like that tea kettle. You know, it's all of a sudden I felt okay in my own skin. And, but then I would I wouldn't know where it would lead. And I would just start, you know, a lot of fights, a lot of insanity. And it was like, because I had that low self-esteem, you know, I'd act out. And for me, like, I get out of college, and it's like, I remember vividly, like, the end of college, everybody was going on to their lives, and I was just so scared, because I didn't know what I was going to do, and I felt like I never got the rule book to life, you know, and I never knew that you could just go get a job, and you'd put one step in front of the other. And I remember people leaving that, you know, college graduation, and I felt so much despair, because I just had no idea what to do. And I ended up, somebody in college took me to my first AA meeting. Probably saw me punch somebody in the face in the bar or something. This guy said, I want to take you somewhere, and he took me to an AA meeting in the basement of a church in Queens. And what I remember is a bunch of old guys, like, you know, 80-year-old guys, and smoke. And then I got that drunk driving I talked about, and you know, what happened is I started going to AA, but I'd go and I'd get the court thing signed, and I would leave, and I'd go light up a joint in the car, and I thought AA is working great for me, you know, it's cured me of my alcoholism, and you know, but I would be smoking weed, and I'd be going to meetings, and for a long time I did that, but I never was in the middle of the boat, you know, I wasn't ready. And so what ended up happening for me is, you know, it didn't take. And I went to AA for 8 years, and I came late and I left early, and I didn't participate, and I didn't get anything. And so I know what it's like to come here and not be a part of it. You know, I've done it both ways, and I could just tell you it's a lot easier being in the middle of it, you know, where you get a sponsor and you use them. You know, you get a home group. You do service, you sponsor other people. And what happened for me is I went to this Club Med, you know, completely, you know, depressed and didn't know what to be. And I got there and I thought, I found my solution, I'm in heaven. And what happened is I was really in hell, because I was there. And I didn't realize that it was the inside stuff that was killing me. It didn't matter where I was miserable in my own skin. And so I got 12-stepped, I went back to New York, and you know, 24 years ago, coming up this year, I did what I was told. You know, I got a sponsor. I lived the program. And I mean, for me, I know there's a higher power, because my life could never have turned out. All the things that I used to talk about on a bar stool, I want to do this, I want to do that, all the things I wanted to do in my life, but I was always afraid of taking the chance to go, you know, go for, I've been able to do in sobriety. And it's not because of anything I've done. It's just I followed directions. And I listened to my sponsor, and I put one foot in front of the other. And, you know, for me, I could just tell you my experience has been, this has been beyond my wildest dreams. I can't believe I'm almost 24 years sober. I can't believe how good my life is. And that's not to say that the last 24 years has been perfect, because life happens and I've got to deal with it. But, you know, I've got this toolkit. And for me, you know, some of the things I've learned along the way is, you know, restraint of pen and tongue has been a real big one. Keeping my mouth shut, you know, not reacting to what goes on around me. And, you know, I always thought the world owed me a living. You know, I got here and I thought everybody owed me. And I was always a con man. I was always what's in it for me. And, you know, I met what happened to me at that Sober Club Med trip is I met these guys from Los Angeles. And the guy that 12-stepped me read me page 449 about acceptance. And it was the first time a light went off. I heard something. And about, you know, Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage, all the men and women merely players. And I was the chief critic. And that if only everybody did what I wanted, everything would be all right. And I was just, you know, I was always let down. And, you know, the higher my expectations, my lower my serenity. And, you know, I always expected people to do things for me. I don't know where I got that from. And, you know, basically, you got to do for yourself. And I always wanted to work on Wall Street. And, you know, 30 years ago, I'd walk around Wall Street, like, knocking on doors, seeing guys that I knew. And, you know, they coached me when I was a kid. And you know, I look back now, and I look like Don Johnson Stones, you know. I'm walking around, I got a bag of weed in my pocket, and I'm wondering why nobody's hiring me. I look like, you know, I'm a top prospect, don't you know? And I look back now, and then 30 years later, you know, like I come out here, I went through a program in New York called EPRA, and that was for educational program for recovering alcoholics, employment program. So they taught you how to be a worker amongst workers. And they taught you how to, you know, get a job and show up for the job. You know, I only worked at nightclubs, and I was always working in scam businesses. And, you know, my higher power has put people in front of me. He's never given me anything more than I can handle. And he's put people in front of me every step of the way. When the student's ready, the teacher appears has been my experience. And, you know, the Wall Street job that I always dreamed of 16 years ago in sobriety, some guy came up to me at the gym and said, hey, man, you should go work on Wall Street, you know, blah, blah, blah. One thing led to another. And, you know, today I'm doing that job that I always dreamed of. And, you know, and it's funny because I always thought, you know, once I had this and this and this, that everything would be all right, you know. And I'm here to tell you my experience has been I've got the things that I thought would fix me, and they don't fix you. And, you know, that's been an interesting lesson because I really see that it's an inside job. And the things that make me feel good about myself today is doing esteemable things, sponsoring guys, passing it on. And, you know, when I first got here, I met all these guys from Club Med, at Club Med that were from L.A., and they, you know, they didn't want anything from me except for me to stay sober. And I remember this guy, Jack, telling me, you know, the only requirement you have is to pass on what was so freely given to you and carry the message, you know. And it's like you get this wonderful life in AA, and, you know, it's important for me not to forget where I came from, you know. And I, you know, the real scary thing for me is I look back over the last 20, you know, I've come into AA for 30 years, and I got 23 and a half, and I look back and I think about, you know, all the guys I met through the years, all the characters. And I mean, the sad thing is, man, it's like, I don't know what the percentages are. You always hear those. But I mean, if 1 in 10 makes it, it's a miracle. From the guys I started with, and I mean, these were guys that were like in the program and did it. And I don't know what the difference is. You know, I've just stayed willing and I keep doing what I'm told. And, you know, I remember coming through my sobriety, you know, I hit a point where, you know, I had a sponsor in LA. I moved to LA to be near this fellowship. And, I had this sponsor, and I would call him, and, you know, I'd get a resentment because he wouldn't call me back, and I realized I need this guy more than he needs me. And it's, you know, now it's my responsibility just to keep calling him, you know, find somebody that has what you want. And the world doesn't owe me anything, you know. It's like the sponsor doesn't owe me anything. I mean, it's been important for me to realize in AA we're all humans, man. It's one alcoholic helping another. There's no leaders here. There's no gurus in AA. And, you know, all the things I learned the first week in sobriety are still the things today that matter, you know. And, you know, now I'm married. You know, I never was in a monogamous relationship in my life. And I've been married 12 years. I haven't ever fooled around on my wife. And I've got a daughter. And my daughter's never seen me drink. And, you know, I'm a sober dad. And, you know, I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me this life that's beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm able to do the right thing, the next right thing. And, you know, my sponsor's here from New York. And, you know, he always says, do today, today. You know, this whole thing's about one day at a time, you know. And it's really important for me, you know, to use the tools that I learned in AA and not, you know, not project and not worry about the future. You know, fear was such a rampant thing in my life that, you know, I'm learning how not to live in fear, you know, and my higher power is there for me, you know, when I hit my knees in the morning and thank him and hit him at night, thank him for keeping me sober. And it took me 20 years in sobriety to learn how to meditate. And, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, you know, and it took, for 10 years, I had people saying to me, you need to meditate, you need to meditate. And so a year ago, I went and followed, I saw somebody in AA that had what I wanted regarding meditation. I went and followed the steps he took me through. I went to TM, which was the way for me, and I learned how to meditate. And, you know, I didn't think I could do that. And I mean, it's been like that the whole step of the way. I mean, if you're new here, find somebody that has what you want. Do what they tell you to do. You know, stay, you know, there are winners here. There are people that want nothing from you except for you to see you succeed in sobriety. I mean, you know, so I learned how to meditate. You know, I carry the message. I mean, it's really, if my message would be one of hope, and I would just tell you that, you know, I've got a home group. It's a men's meeting that I go to in San Francisco, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday at Old St. Mary's at noon if you're ever in town. And, you know, my experience has been, man, if you... anything's possible in sobriety. You can do anything you want to do. I, you know, my passion in life was playing basketball, and what I've done in sobriety is I've learned that, you know, I love playing basketball. It's the time where I go out there and I shoot hoops, and I'm not thinking about anything. My brain is turned off. Nothing else matters. And so what do I do in sobriety? I spend at least 10 minutes every day shooting hoops. Do what you love. Do more of what you love. If you don't like doing something, try not to do it, you know? And if you have people in your life that are cancer, man, that are not building you up, get rid of them. I remember keeping people in my life, man, and it was like every time I talked to them, I felt bad afterwards. You know what? Life's too short. Cut them out. You know, get people that'll build you up, man. And, you know, I just got to say, man, my life is, again, I mean, I can't believe how good it is. And it's one day at a time. And, you know, I mean, this you guys are really fortunate to be at something like this, man, because this... you know, this. I went home and told my wife last night, I mean, how amazing this is and how young. And, you know, it's just the energy, you know. I feel very fortunate to be a part of this AA family. And it was the first time in my life I always thought that nobody understood me. And I realized that, you know, I'm a garden variety alcoholic. There's nothing special about me. I'm a worker amongst workers, you know, and I'm just another, you know, alcoholic. And if you're struggling here, man, reach out. Put yourself in the middle of the boat, man. Participate in your own recovery. And, you know, I love AA. Thank you.
Let's welcome our second speaker, Steve E. from San Francisco, California.
Thanks. I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Steve.
It's good to be here today. It's good to be at Icky Paw. I've been part of the host committee for almost the past year, and I got to say, it's pretty crazy to, I don't know, I've been talking about this thing. I remember, like, I was the co-events chair for this conference, which meant leading up to the conference, one of the people responsible for putting on all kinds of events all over the state, trying to get people amped up for it, and I just can't fathom that last October we were sitting in somebody's living room talking about this conference that was so far away, and here we are, and it's totally amazing. I went to my first conference, my first young person's conference, when I had about a year of sobriety. It was Wacky Paw in the year 2000. I got sober in the year 2000. I was 18 years old. And I feel pretty lucky. I found young persons pretty early. There was a young person's group where I got sober up in Marin County. But I never really, you know, I found young persons early, but I never really felt like I fit in young persons. But I'm super grateful that I came to conferences and came to those meetings and saw other young people who were staying sober, who were doing the deal. I mean, it's funny these days, you know, I was talking to people at my home group and other places about, oh, you got to come to this young person's conference. And they're like, oh, I'm not a young person. I don't think I'll get it. I don't know what you guys are doing down there. And I'm like, we do AA. That's what we do. You know, nothing that special. And in fact, you know, it's so crazy. You know, the young people that I've met at conferences and in young people's groups are so fired up about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really do feel like there's an energy that you get from a conference that you, a young person's conference specifically, that you just don't get anywhere else. And I'm really grateful to be here. So this is a men's panel, Stag Life. And I was like, what are they doing asking me to speak on this panel? I did literally say that as a gay man. I was kind of like, I don't know if this is if this is the right panel for me to speak on. But I guess technically I am a man, and so I have some experience to share here. But before I jump into specifically being a man or whatever that means to me or what that means to me now, I want to qualify. I think it's something important that we do whenever we share is. We talk about what it was like, what happened, how we got here, why I'm an alcoholic. So, as I said, I got sober when I was 18 years old, and I used to have some shame around that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought people would think I'm not a real alcoholic, or that I was less of an alcoholic, or more really, I thought, you know, it's not like I saw a problem coming down the road and thought, oh, you know, I should get sober before things get bad. You know, I wish that was possible. You know, in my experience, I don't think anybody gets sober before things get bad. You know, I feel like I got sober young, but not early. And what that means for me is by the time I was 18 years old, my life was really falling apart and I was going to die if I didn't get sober. And even knowing that I was going to die if I didn't get sober, I still didn't really want to get sober or care that much about it. By the time I got here, I had already been in a couple of outpatient rehab programs. The first one I had gone to was a group-based outpatient program, and I had convinced my parents it was not a good idea for me to be hanging out with all those other drug addicts and alcoholics. So they put me in this private outpatient program, private one-on-one therapy, and I'm super grateful. The therapist that I saw before I got sober, she never told me she was an alcoholic, but I found out later that she was. And what she did very gently is she introduced me to the disease of alcoholism, and she explained that if I was an alcoholic, that I was suffering from this disease. And it was a disease of the mind and the body, she told me. She used to play these videotapes for me from the 80s. They were pretty funny. I wish I could find them. They were pretty awful. But they laid out very gently this idea that, you know, if I was an alcoholic, the problem was is that any time I picked up drugs or alcohol, I had to have more. And that wouldn't be such a problem if I just stayed away from the first drink, but that I have this mind that obsesses about picking up the first drink, and that, you know, even when I abstain from drugs and alcohol, I've got this little voice that pops in that says, you know, it'd be all right to have one, you know, next time you'll be able to have one. And so I was in this outpatient program, I wasn't getting it at all. Even though she was laying these tools at my feet, I still didn't really think I was an alcoholic. But you know, the last year of my drinking and using was terrible. You know, I had gotten into this cycle where I wanted to stop, and every time I picked up a drink or a drug, I told myself I was never going to do this again. And I got into this habit of, you know, I tell myself that I could, this time I would control it. You know, I got some money in my pocket. I was kind of a binge drinker, user. I would go on these sprees. I'd get some money in my pocket. I'd say, oh, I'm going to buy $200 worth of drugs and alcohol, but I'm just going to do a little bit, just a little bit. I'm going to save this. This is going to last for weeks. That was what I always told myself. And 6 hours later, you know, I'd be out of money, out of drugs, out of alcohol, and I'd tell myself, I'm never going to do this again. And I meant it, you know, and I would tell all my friends too, you know, I'm done this time. I've got it. You know, I know this is the end for me. And I pass out, you know, the next day I'd wake up and I swear the next morning already, you know, I'd think, well, you know what, next time I think I can just have one. You know, too many drugs, not enough alcohol. I shouldn't have hung out with this friend. It's him. He, I always go on these crazy things when I hang out with him. And I just had this cycle of where I wanted to stop, genuinely wanted to stop, but I just couldn't. And I kept picking up that first drink. So I was in this outpatient program, one-on-one therapy, wasn't getting it, was supposed to be going to AA meetings, and I kept going, I'd never been to an AA meeting in my life, but I kept going into this therapist's office and telling her, oh, I went to this great meeting, I heard somebody share, it was so great, oh yeah, never been to a meeting, I don't even know how I knew what to lie about, but I was such a good liar. I was such a good liar when I got sober, I remember that. I went to an independent study school because my life was so fucked up. And you meet one-on-one with the teacher once a week for an hour. Really bad idea for an alcoholic. But I remember I was supposed to be reading this one book, Sophie's World, and I was reading Sophie's Choice instead. And for like 6 months, we would have discussions about the book. And I wasn't reading either book, really. But I bought the wrong book, and my teacher and I were discussing, you know, two different books. But I was such a good liar, she didn't even pick up on it for 6 months. It was pretty bad. So I was lying about, you know, getting sober. My parents were drug testing me pretty regularly at this point, and some things you can lie about. Oh, it's just carrying over. It's just still in my system, you know. But eventually, stuff is supposed to stop showing up on those things, you know, if you're really sober, and it wasn't. So I had this great idea, and my great idea was that if I told everybody I was going into rehab, that they would get off my back long enough that I could go out and really drink and use the way I wanted to. And that's all I thought about, is just, you know, getting to that first drink. Whatever I had to do to get, I knew once I got that first drink in my body, you know, everything would be okay, you know, everything would be taken care of. So that's all I thought out to. So I had this big plan. I was going to get my parents and my therapist together and tell them I was going to rehab. And so I gathered them all together. I remember it was a Friday morning, and I gathered them together, and I was like, you know what, this just isn't working for me. I feel like I need to go to treatment. And my therapist was like, great, here's a phone book, call a rehab. And this was not part of my plan. And so I picked up the phone, and there was this place, I was living over in Marin, and there was this place up in Marin, and I called them, and they were like, we have an opening today. And I was like, well, today's not good for me, but how about Monday? And and they said, okay, you can come in Monday. And I left that therapist's office once again thinking, I'm just going to go have one. I'm just going to go control it. It's going to be great. And I remember, no matter how much drugs and alcohol I did that night, I could not get that sense of relief that I was looking for. I had all the physical side effects of being really wasted out of my mind, but it was like I couldn't even get not even a tiny little bit of relief. And all I could feel is how once again I had said I was just going to have one drink, one drug, and once again, once I got anything into my system, I just had to have more. So that was June 9th of the year 2000. That weekend, I had just turned 18. My 18th birthday was terrible. My parents got me McDonald's gift certificates in $1 denominations because they didn't want to have anything that I could sell or get. I didn't want me to have anything I could get change back from. So it was pretty miserable, but it had just been my 18th birthday. That Monday, I was supposed to graduate from high school. It was the day of my high school graduation. And instead of going to my high school graduation, I showed up at rehab. And you know, I didn't think I was getting sober. You know, I didn't think that, oh, this is it. I'm going to be sober for the next, you know, 11 years. I really thought, you know, I just needed to dry out. I just needed to get away from drugs and alcohol. I just needed to get away from my life for a little bit. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that, I don't know, for me, I don't think anybody's ever, like, ready to get, you know, to get sober. I think that if I had been waiting until I was ready, I would still be out there drinking today, you know, because that's what was happening to me, is I kept waiting to have some change in my thinking. Some, you know, oh yeah, now I get it, it all clicks. And you know, that never happened for me. What happened is I showed up at rehab and they said, look, you know, if you want to stay sober, the way that you're going about trying to stay sober doesn't work, you know. And that the only thing that we know that really works is if you completely stay away from drugs and alcohol and you do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really grateful I went to a treatment center that was 12-step based. And, you know, they didn't, they basically said right from the start, look, we can keep you sober for maybe 30 days, but, you know, after that, you know, you'll probably pick up a drink again unless you do something more. And they gave me a big book. And I remember I was 18 years old. This little shy, scared, I'm 6'3". I was like 132 pounds when I got sober. My face was kind of literally like greenish in color. And I had kind of long hair, but part of it was blonde, but just part, like right here. I don't think anybody thought that I was going to stay sober there, but they gave me a big book and they said, read Bill's story. I remember, you know, I think they were so worried that I wasn't going to relate, you know, as an 18-year-old gay young kid, you know, was I really going to relate to this story? And I started reading Bill's story by myself up in my cabin the first night I was there. And I was interested in it. I was so desperate to get sober, you know, and I had been trying on my own, but just unable to actually do it for such a long time. I was really interested in, was this program really going to work? And I remember I got to that part in Bill's story where he says, you know, and I finally had it, you know, and I had it figured out. And this time I meant business, and my wife knew I meant business, and I knew that I was really going to stay sober. And I remember pausing there and thinking, shit, you know. You know, I'd had that feeling so many times before, but every time I had that feeling, I ended up getting loaded. And I thought, you know, I don't think this is going to work for me. And I kept reading, and the next line in the book is actually, and I found myself loaded again, and I didn't know why. And it was the first time I think I had related to another alcoholic, you know, directly, was in reading Bill's story. And in seeing that, you know, here was this guy who had that same feeling, that same, you know, I had it, I really meant business. And then, you know, he picked up a drink. And what I love about Bill's story is he writes about doing that another two or three times, you know, where it's like, oh, and this time I had it, you know, and then he was drunk again. And so for the first time, I think, in my life, I related to another alcoholic in that story, and I thought maybe this thing can work for me too. So, what happened from there? I got a sponsor, and maybe this is where I can start to kind of transition a little bit into, you know, stag life or being man. I got this guy as my sponsor. His name was Charles, and he had gotten sober at about the same age as I had, as I was, 18, and he had like four or five years of sobriety, but we had nothing in common. He was this straight guy from Marin, the surfer guy, really outgoing. Everybody liked him. He was really attractive. He was like everything that I absolutely wasn't. And somebody had recommended it to me, and I started working with this guy. And, you know, I've heard a lot of different things about, you know, why to pick a sponsor or how to pick a sponsor. I don't know, you know. The way that I look at it, I just needed somebody to take me through the steps. And, you know, I remember this guy, Charles, took time out of his week every week on a Thursday night, and he would spend the whole evening with me. He would pick me up from the halfway house that I was living at. We'd go to his house. We'd read the big book in the 12x12, and then we'd go to a meeting, a men's stag meeting, where he had gotten me a commitment as the coffee person, and I'd make coffee, and then we'd go to dinner, and then we'd go to the meeting. And, you know, like I said, I didn't have anything in common with this guy, but for, you know, over a year, this guy took time out of his life and his schedule to work the steps with me. And I was a pretty sick alcoholic. And I remember I came out of the closet in early sobriety, and I was so excited. And I was like, yay, now I get to, you know, have sex and do whatever I want. And my first sponsor was of the mind like, kept hearing in the rooms, oh, you know, you don't have sex for your first year of sobriety. And my sponsor, Charles, was actually like, I don't know what a year of sobriety is going to give you. You know, you can still be totally batshit crazy and sick after your sobriety. But he was like, Why don't we say, you know, wait until after you've worked the steps. So I worked the steps so quickly my first year of sobriety. It still took me about a year to get through the steps. And, you know, I'm really grateful that that I got through the steps with that sponsor. I kind of had this opinion, once I ask somebody to sponsor me, unless they turn out to really be a lunatic, I at least finish working the steps with them. Because I swear, every time I get to about the fourth step, I have the world's worst sponsor. You know, they're a jerk, they don't get me, they don't understand me, they don't know. And I've just made this decision that whenever I work with somebody, I at least finish out the steps with them. And that's what I did with this guy. So, you know, I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking a little bit about, since the panel is, you know, a men's panel in Stag Life, like what it means for me today to be me, to be a man, you know. I started working with another sponsor a little while after that, who took me through this inventory where one of the questions on the inventory was actually, in what ways do I feel inadequate as a man? And, you know, at the time, I remember I wrote all these things, and I thought I was really, really unique. You know, I thought as a young person, I hated myself. I hated the way I looked. I hated the way I acted. You know, I was gay, and I just felt so uncomfortable in my own skin. And I had all these things on this list and ways that I felt inadequate. And I thought I was really unique, you know. And what I've come to learn over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, gay, straight, whatever, you know, we all suffer from the same things. We all have the same fears. We all have the same stuff going on deep down inside. It was through that process of working that inventory the second time that I think things really started to change in my life. It's so crazy to stand here now. I've been sober for 11 years, which truly is a miracle for an alcoholic like me who couldn't stay sober for more than a couple days before he got here. And I've been sober for 11 years. And, you know, I had the opportunity to go to school in sobriety and graduate. And I have a job. I've had this job. I've worked at this company for the past 6 years and kind of grown up there. I've really, like, had an opportunity to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and to really become a person that I didn't think I was ever capable of becoming. I want to say, you know, at 8 years of sobriety, something happened to me. This event happened to me, and you know, there's a saying in AA, you know, if your ass falls off, pick it up and take it to a meeting. And I thought that is the stupidest saying I've ever heard in my life. I don't understand what that means. How does your ass fall off? That's ridiculous. But at 8 years of sobriety, my ass actually basically fell off. And what happened was I had this problem that came up in my life that I thought was too big for Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, before this thing had come up, I'd never thought about anything like that. But this thing hit me and I was totally unprepared for it. And I really thought, this is just too big. I don't know how I'm going to stay sober through this. And I called my sponsor, because that's what I do. That's what I've learned to do around here. And my sponsor was so gentle. And in this way, he was like, oh, well, you know, you need advanced AA. And I thought, oh, my God, yes, finally. I'm 8 years sober. I am ready for advanced AA. Yes, this is it. And my sponsor said to me, the next line he said was, you know, we learn advanced AA in our first 30 days of sobriety. He was like, so, you know, you need to go to a meeting every single day and work the steps, you know, work with your sponsees, call me every day. And that's what I did. And I got through that thing. I basically picked my ass up and took it to a meeting. I still think that's a stupid saying. But so you know, AA works. It's worked for me for 11 years. It's given me this life that I couldn't possibly have dreamed of. I'm still as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as I was 11 years ago. You know, as I said, I've been part of this host committee, which has been awesome. If you're new, or even if you're not new, you know, if you're not involved in Alcoholics Anonymous or you don't feel involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, I say get involved. You know, even as somebody who maybe is involved, you don't always have to feel, you know, like you love it or you're a part of. I feel like most of the service I've done, I always feel like an outsider doing it, but I've done it and I've stayed here. So I just want to close with this reading from step four in the 12x12, which really kind of sums up a lot for me and even a lot about being a man in sobriety. It's from 53, the fourth step. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. Our egomania digs two disastrous pitfalls. Either we insist upon dominating the people we know, or we depend upon them far too much. We have not once sought to be in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among worker, to be a useful member of sobriety. Always we tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relation with any one of those about us. Of true brotherhood, we had small comprehension. And, you know, standing up here today, I feel like, you know, I have a brotherhood with, you know, people in Alcoholics Anonymous, something that I couldn't imagine before I got sober, and I wouldn't have even ever thought of. And I'm so grateful to be sober today. I want to thank all of you for helping me stay sober and for being here today. So, thanks.
Let's welcome our third speaker, Scott M. from Santa Barbara, California.
My name is Scott. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I, like the previous speakers, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I'm sitting here listening, I'm thinking, I love it because both of these gentlemen describe themselves and their life and who they are and where their background is, and I do not relate with that at all, but I can absolutely 100% relate to both your stories, and I've never been able to get that before except in AA, so thanks you guys for sharing your stories. It's awesome. Thanks, Ikipa, for asking me and allowing me to come out and speak at this meeting. I would not have been here except for the meeting. I had prior family commitments both before and immediately after, so literally, that's why I don't even have my tag. I suck because I didn't go right up to the registration booth, but literally, I pulled in, I came in here, and I got to leave right away, but I will still register before I leave this meeting. Self-supporting through our own contributions, right? So thank you for allowing me to be able to come out here and giving me a reason to come to Ikipa. And I've heard lots of great things about this conference so far, so my hat's off to you. So my my sobriety date is December 1st, 2004, and I have a sponsor, and I have a sponsee, and I've had sponsees. I've taken men, you know, all the way through the steps, and I have been taken all the way through the steps by a couple different men. I also have a home group, and the home group is actually in Sacramento because that's my hometown. I am in Santa Barbara right now, and it's a men's meeting, and it's a Capital City men's group. It's on 13th and N downtown. It's been my home group for probably about 4 or 5 years now, and it's crazy because I always thought men's meetings were kind of a little corny, a little I don't know, just for weirdos, I suppose, but call me a weirdo. I love my meeting. You know, I show up there, you know, every time I'm in town, if I don't have an excuse, I get up early at 7:30 in the morning, go to that meeting, and without fail, every speaker that we haven't come in complains about the fact that the meeting's at 7:30 in the morning, in a joking way. It's nice to have a sense of humor. December 4th, that week before, and really the 6 months prior leading up to me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous was not necessarily a good period in my life. That 6 months before, I was going to Sac State. I was trying to get a college degree. I had been sent to their on-campus psychiatric ward there, and I was meeting with someone, and was talking about making all kinds of suggestions about I should try this, I should look at this, I should look at that. And eventually I was actually asked to leave campus because I was showing up drunk at 7 o'clock in the morning to my first class. And I had lost my job. I had this job. I was waiting tables like most people do in school. And I was so drunk on my last shift within, you know, like a couple weeks prior to me going into the program that I went and took an order at a table, and I went back to the kitchen, and I turned in the ticket, and I was about ready to hit the concrete in the back of the kitchen in front of all my peers that I, without trying to make as much scene as possible, I walked out of the restaurant and out to the parking lot to a place where no one was around, and I did a face plant in the bushes, and I was there for over a day. It was in the pouring rain. It was in December. My skin was turning yellow, my hair was falling out, my fingernails were getting brittle. I was definitely getting some yellow jaundice from alcohol, and my cat was absolutely scared of me. I think animals have a unique sense of being able to smell death, and mine was definitely smelling it on me. Wouldn't even come near me. And I had a girlfriend slash about-to-be fiancé that I had been with for probably about 3 or 4 years with, and I was madly in love with. And it was one of those relationships that basically checked all the boxes, you know, physical, spiritual, emotional, and all those things. And I mean, I was completely happy with her. And that last week, I had embarrassed her at her family party for the last time, and she pulled up in front of the house that I was living in at the time, which I was about to be evicted in probably about 2 days later, dropped me off, rolled down her window, and said, you know, you don't need to call me, you don't need to write me, you don't need to do anything to me. She said, you are anthropologically unfit for mating, and took off from there. And and it's amazing. I don't know why that's funny, but she was very smart. She was very specific with her words, you know. Because at that point in time in my life, I was not a man of God. I was a man of science. And so basically she was telling me of all the silverback gorillas, I basically had no silverback gorilla, you know. I was like, you know, and I can see it now looking back. Like, there's no way on God's green earth that I would ever be a good husband, or a potential good father, or even a good friend to her, living the life that I was living. I was spiritually, financially, emotionally, physically, every kind of bankrupt that I could possibly be at that point in time in my life. And I was just a complete freaking mess. And the craziest thing about all that, when I look back now, is that when I looked at myself, I honestly thought, it's not that bad. You know, it ain't that bad. It could be worse. And it kept me going another day, you know, like it just was not that bad. Everyone else around me, you know, trying to like do all kinds of like, you know, Bugs Bunny tricks on me, sneaking me into interventions that I would find out and, you know, go find something else to do. But I don't know, it's just a trip, man. I love AA, and my life is completely different today because of that. And so I'll share a little bit more about that. But it's weird, you know, like that how I described myself right before I came into the program, it was not always like that. It was it was a progression that built up to that. And like the gentleman that shared today, you know, I would always find an excuse and say tomorrow will be different, or I'll stop this time, or as it says in the book, you know, swearing this off or trying something different, you know, vodka or beer or only on the weekends or with this particular friend, or maybe I just won't drive or what have you, and just finding different ways to, you know, never saying it's the alcohol, you know, or thinking that I'm an alcoholic. I would much rather, and I was in a mental hospital for 3 months, I would much rather be diagnosed as a psychotic, murdering, sociopathic, crazy, whatever, than being labeled an alcoholic. I don't know what it is about that term, but I'd be anything else besides an alcoholic, you know. And to me, I think maybe in my mind back then, I thought that as soon as I admitted that, my life was over, you know. Like, it was just, you know, you might as well throw me in jail, penitentiary. My life was over. I had nothing else to live for. And it's because at that point in time, that's the only thing that I live for. So, of course, I'm going to think that, you know. And again, Alcoholics Anonymous has, you know, taught me a new way of life and found me that it is not a boring and glum life. I've got a very full life today. So, as I said, my life was not always like that, and I didn't always drink like that. Growing up in Sacramento, I'm a fourth generation Sacramentan. My earliest memory is I'd be sitting at the dinner table with my family, and I have a fairly small family, but we'd have guests over every once in a while. It was a round table, and I'd always be sitting at the table sideways like this, with half ass off the chair. You know, one leg over here, one leg over here, basically shoving food in my mouth. I would not know what's going on around me, not be paying attention to anything. I'd just be focused on like shoving food in my mouth. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, without fail, almost every single meal, I get a slap on my shoulder, and it was always my mom who sat next to me so she can keep me under control. Say, Scott. Yeah. She said, look. And I'd look, and my foot would be on the table, leg, and it would be shaking so much that the water in the glasses would be shaking over the ledge of the thing, you know. And it's because I always had this feeling that I had to be somewhere else, I had to be somewhere else. I had to be someone else. I had to be doing something else. I did not feel comfortable there. It didn't matter if it was Christmas Eve and the people who absolutely loved me were surrounded in, you know, the most protective environment, or if I was out in a mall left by myself with 1,000 people I didn't know with just chaos and anarchy. I always felt the exact same thing, and that was fear. I felt really, really fearful. I don't know what it was, but I couldn't even describe it. You know, it was not at an age where I can describe that feeling, other than that when I look back now, it's probably kind of like a, you know, a field mouse with a hawk above it 24/7, you know, like my heart racing. And I don't know, it was a trip. I just felt like I was in escape mode 24/7, completely running on instinct. And having felt like that and being uncomfortable with being able to handle fear or not having a solution, you know, if you got a cold, you can go down to Rite Aid and you get cold medicine. If you got a headache, you can take an Advil or something else like that. But they really don't prescribe anything for fear. But I did find one thing that worked, and that was when I was about 15 or 16 years old. The friends that I had at that time, which I'm still friends with today, had started drinking. They started having, you know, they were smoking pot at the time, and they were drinking beer long before me, because I always thought, yeah, you guys are stupid. You know, I thought they acted really goofy, and I would tell them, you guys are acting really retarded, you know. But through the nice tutelage and the support of them, I found out. I actually should back up for just one moment. I will say that I remember one time in my garage, and I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and my dad was in there, and he was shining up his clubs to go golfing. He had a beer in his hand, and he asked me if I wanted to have a drink. And my dad has a keen sense of being able to introduce me to a lot of stuff in my entire lifetime. And I remember taking a taste of that beer and thinking it was the most disgusting tasting, and I could not believe that someone would actually choose to drink that stuff. So I was immediately repulsed by alcohol, and I think that was part of, when I got into being 15 and 16 with my friends, why I just thought it was kind of dumb. But I found out through them that if I drank more than one, you know, and if I had an empty stomach, that this most amazing thing happened to me. And I hear a lot of people in AA describe, like, they remember very clearly the first time that they drank alcohol, that they became the smartest person in the room, or they became like the most, you know, powerful person in the room, or all this stuff. The effect for me was that I just didn't care. You know, like when I had those two beers that first time, it was the first time in my life that I didn't care. And when I say I didn't care, it meant that I wasn't completely fearful of anything. You know, it's not like I was, you know, angry or all this stuff. The effect on the alcohol had for me is that I just didn't give a damn, and I wasn't afraid, and I could go anywhere and not, like, you know, pompous or whatever. I could just finally freaking be. Like, I have found the solution that had been missing in my entire life. When I was 5 years old sitting at that dinner table, I needed a drink, and I didn't know it. And you know, the result of that, having finally found the solution that had been missing my entire life, is that I chased alcohol 24/7 every day thereafter. And it wasn't just because I wanted to go out and party and have fun, although there was a lot of times that I partied and had fun. It was just because I wanted to seek that feeling of just being okay and not being absolutely completely terrified, you know, and fearful of people, places, things, situations. The stuff that I had did yesterday, or the fact that I had no idea what was going to go on tomorrow, the fact that, as this gentleman over here mentioned, you know, that there was a rule book, you know, like, I felt the same way. I felt like that somehow someone had gone through and whispered a secret in everybody's ear their entire life, exactly what to do, and I'm the only one who missed that secret. I distinctly remember going to this dead-end job, absolutely hating it, in this terse cell that had 4 different hubcaps, and I would be driving in the morning, and I'd be looking at the cars next to me, and looking at them and just totally, like, absolutely obsessed on how they drove their car and how they looked at themselves and how confident and how they looked like they had purpose and wherever it is that they were going, and wondering, how the hell do they do it? You know, like, seriously, like, I have no idea how to live this life, and I don't know what I'm going to do, and I don't know where I'm going. And that was the source of that fear. And so I would always, from then on, man, I'd have a 40 in my lap when I'm driving, and it'd be like, you know, that's what made it okay. I stopped looking at those people and wondering. I just basically went day-to-day existing. And over a long period of time, man, alcohol absolutely tore me down, as I had mentioned before. There's a lot of stuff that, I can go on all these dumbass stories that I have throughout my entire life, just bad decisions, you know. I'd never made a good decision when I was drinking. I didn't make a good decision when I was sober, but they got a lot worse when I was drinking. I had a couple weeks before that where I had talked about where I'd reached what I didn't know was a particular bottom, but I was absolutely blacked out. And a friend of mine, I was homeless at the time, so my mom was internationally traveling for 6 months, so I had broken into her house, and I was either staying in her shed in the backyard when she was home before, or I was staying in her house when she wasn't home. And I got so blitzed one time, and the last friend that I had, who was the last sort of drinking buddy that I had known where I was going, or at least suspected, and he broke into my mom's house, and I'll never forget it. Like, I was completely blacked out. My cat was over there. It was concrete floor because her house was being completely remodeled. And I remember coming from a blackout, and he had me by the shoulders, and he was standing above me, and he was shaking me like, "Yay, Scott. Scott, are you all right?" You know, like, I kind of remember coming to, and he's just looking over me. He's like, "Dude, what the hell are you doing?" You know, like, he had seen me go through this for quite a while. And, you know, I'd sworn off like people had talked about for quite a while. And it was the most, I can hear myself talking to him when he's saying, "Why do you keep doing this?" And I said, "I don't know, you know. Like, I have no honest answer or no clue as to why I keep doing this, you know. Like, I had no idea how to live. I had no idea why I would make this decision. I just know that as an alcoholic, as I've learned in these rooms, that I had this allergy of the body and I had this obsession in the mind. And as a couple people have described it before, like whenever I would have, whenever I would have that first drink, it's almost like it would create an itch in me, an itch that had to be scratched. And I had to scratch it more and more. The more I scratched, the more I itched it, the more it scratched. And for me, it always led to a blackout. And sometimes it was really quick, and sometimes it was over days or weeks, you know. And I find myself walking around the streets of Sacramento with bloodied feet, you know, completely in a blackout. But that was that allergy, you know. And then when I would stop or swear it off over a period of time, I would obsess over it. That's all I would think about. So what happened for me is that guy who stood over me took me into a meeting of AA in Elk Grove. And it was I felt completely uncomfortable in there. And I went up to this guy, and he's like, he basically like got me to a point where I can stand up. Went up to this guy, and I said, you know, they talked about, you know, getting a sponsor. And I asked him, you know, "Hey, will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Well, what are you willing to do to stay sober?" And for the first time in my life, I was willing to do anything. You know, I honestly was. So he spent every week, you know, my friend would take me out to his house out in Elk Grove, and I'd sit across the kitchen table with him. And he's like, "I got this big book when I was in this mental hospital, this one right here, and thank God I brought it with me today." And he would make me highlight and underline and do all this stuff. And he talked to me about, like, you know, the first step, and really broke it down for me in a way that it was almost kind of like I was starting to get that secret that I talked about, that these guys talked about, that I started to understand myself for the first time ever. And then we got to the third step, and for me, man, being a man of science, I was absolutely terrified. In his house, we read, you know, we went through the step, and then we had to read this third step prayer. And I'm not one for praying. I'm not one for even talking about God or being religious or whatever it is it means to you. It just meant to me that my life was going to be over again. So he literally said, you know, like, very matter-of-factly, like, "Business, all right, get up out of your chair. You know, like, hey, you're going to hold my hands. We're going to get down. You're going to read this thing right here." And I did it. And, like, crazy thing was, like, I didn't, like, spontaneously combust and light on fire, you know, like. But what it did for me was it completely removed that fear, you know. Like, it was the first time ever that I had prayed with another man. I was on my knees. I was humbling myself before someone or something that I didn't understand yet. And, you know, he made me get into this thing called a fourth step. And I had to sit down, and what I was writing out for me was a hit list, you know. And it's crazy because I wrote out this list of things that we learn about when you go through the steps. And for the first time in my life ever, when I got back to meet with him, he pointed out this thing that I had never seen before in my entire life. And that was, my part. And I was like, wow, what could I have done differently? And how do I repair this? Because everybody, I don't know about you, but everybody in my life was tired of hearing sorry. So I had to learn about, how to say, how can I fix this? How can I amend it? And it's funny, AA, you start to learn those things. What does it mean to repair or restore something versus saying sorry? Putting action behind it. I had never learned that before. There's so much stuff I've learned. The magic for me, and it's not really magic because magic is often fake. This is like the real stuff where my life really changed was in the ninth step. And that woman that had dropped me off at the house at one point in time, I had to go amend that situation. So I meant I had to go, call her up and ask if I could meet with her. And she lived up in Grass Valley, so there was a date and time. And I showed up to the house, and not only her, but her parents were there. There was six or seven people there in the backyard sitting, waiting for me, anticipating what I was going to do. And in my mind, I was going to save that relationship. I was going to go in there, and the balloons were going to drop, and the confetti was going to go off, and they were going to be so happy for me and say, we've been waiting for this for a long time. Thank God, Scott. We absolutely love you. And so I sit down, and I start to do the amends, and for the, as it was taught for me, is admitting exactly how they had not been treated right, and how they should have been treated. And is there anything that I can do differently? And it's crazy because all that stuff that I had hoped for didn't happen. The father stood up and said, Scott, we appreciate you coming out here, and we're really glad that you're doing whatever it is that you got to do for yourself. But now that you're done, you need to get up and you need to leave our property, and you need to never come back here again, and you need to never call us again. And if you see us in the grocery store, you need to stay on that side of the store. Don't wave at us. Don't do anything. You just stay away. And they marched me off they literally walked me off the property and said, good riddance. But it's crazy. This is what for me is amazing. When it talks about we came to believe, that's when I came to believe, because when I was walking back to my truck, it was the first time ever, that I actually felt like I literally felt like I was standing a little taller. I actually felt like I was a little bit lighter on my heels. I actually felt like I was a little clearer in my eyes. And I remember just sitting in my truck thinking, man, that's the secret, there's a solution to my problems. And it's not about fixing that stuff, but it's the whole thing, I got out of my car and I felt free. I survived. I didn't die, I wasn't fearful of them or people or anything else. I finally had a tool or a solution that can get me through life, I wasn't terrified or anything. And you know what? I've been absolutely burning for AA ever since. And, I've been involved in AA as these guys are talking about. I've been the same involved in AA as I was then. I got commitments, and I show up for stuff, and I stay willing. And there's a lot of things that I have to do in AA, but the results are the same, and that is that I don't experience that same fear that I described before, and I don't have to drink over it, no matter what. I stay sober, and I'm glad to be in a men's meeting on this men's panel. And just one little story, and I'll wrap it up here, is that a couple of things. I wish I could go through this list of stuff that I've learned in AA, because it really has completely revolutionized my life. But a couple, I have, number one, I'm married now, and I've got a wonderful wife, and she's just amazing. We've got a great relationship because of this program, and what I have is the higher power now. I've got two kids today, so I'm anthropologically fit for mating. I'm proud to tell all of you that. And we're going to have another. Number three is last week my son came down with some sort of sickness, my almost two-year-old, and he had to be admitted to the hospital immediately, and he had to have emergency surgery, and he had this intestinal thing, and it's just a scary thing if you've got kids or a family member that you adore, and to see that happen. And at the time I was in Santa Barbara, and he was being admitted in Sacramento, so I had to get on the road and get down there. And while we were in that hospital the whole week, and when we went through the procedure, it was just the craziest thing. You just never expect it. It's kind of cool to see this stuff. People see it before we see it, or I see it. One of the nurses came in, and they were getting ready to dismiss us, and the nurse said, I just got to tell you how much we've enjoyed having you guys in here. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird, you know, like we're in a freaking hospital and they did surgery, you know. Like, but the lady said, you know, all the doctor staff and the nurses staff and everybody said, just how nice you and your wife are, you know, like given what's going on, but you guys have seriously have been really pleasant to deal with, you know, like you guys have been really level-headed. You've not been like overreacting. I guess they have a lot of patients that overreact to stuff. You've not been overly demanding, and you've not made a scene, and you've not been this, and you've not been that, and you guys have just been a pleasure to serve. And I just think, man, you know, like, that is seriously Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, you know? I didn't have a fear over my son. I just had a, you know, we just got right into doing what was the next right thing, which is checking him in and praying over it, you know, and just doing what we got to do and the stuff that I learned in the program. And, you know, I could go on with a ton of different things, but that's just the most recent thing in my life where I see the benefits of AA and being sober. So we are at 0 minutes. Done. Thank you, guys. And let's go Icky Paw.
Let's thank our speakers again and readers for their service today. I've asked Josh to read a vision for you.